It's easy to get lost. This is The Revenue Maze, and I'm Valerie Cobb. Join me as we navigate the halls, dead ends, and U-turns on your path towards upward growth trajectory. The Revenue Maze is sponsored by Revenue North Star, guidance and execution through fractional revenue leadership, uncovering hidden revenues, and empowering small business growth through process-driven sales customized to your company environment. Welcome, everybody, to another great episode of The Revenue Maze. I am really almost mellow today for my guest because it's so fun to talk to him. And you're going to love it. So this guest, wow, if you want to hear about stories of going from 3 million to 5 billion with AWS, that is fabulous. And three startups with three acquisitions, which is super exciting. And there's a little word like Oracle in the day. And he is very active in pediatric health for special needs children, which is super. There'll probably be some of that in this show as well. And I just want to welcome CEO and founder of Shoreline.io. Welcome, Anurag Gupta.
Hi. It's great to see you.
It is so great to see you as well. And like I said, it feels a bit like, and I think the audience will feel that way as well. It just feels like everything calms down when you're having a conversation with you. So I'm so excited about this. And the show, obviously, it's The Revenue Maze. So the first thing that we always talk about is what is one thing that you can help tell listeners and viewers that will help them get out of The Revenue Maze?
I think people get really anxious about hitting their numbers and so forth, which I totally get. I'm anxious about it right now. But I think anxiety doesn't get you anywhere, right? It just creates stress. So what I really have been trying to focus on is how do I focus on my customer pain? How do I relate to them? How do I try to align what I'm doing with their service? Or, you know, if it's irrelevant, then maybe direct them to something else which is currently an issue for them, and, you know, earn some credits that way.
Sure. Yeah. I mean, honestly, so a lot don't know, you know, but I was kind of wound up when we were getting started, and you kind of just said, hey, let's talk about this and let's focus. And I think anxiety and stress are a huge portion of why people do miss goals. But I love also why you said, hey, focus on the pain of what the customer needs. And mm-hmm. So how do you do that? Give us some pointers on how you kind of slow it down, focus, and then say, okay, what is going on in the customer's world?
Well, you know, that's really a lesson I learned at Amazon, because, you know, they always strove to, they still strive to be Earth's most customer-centric company. And then, you know, that's not about like individual events. It's about creating mechanisms to extinguish the problems your customers face. I have to say that, you know, after having worked at Amazon, it made me somewhat intolerant of the customer service I received at other places, because, you know, there was a time that they were absolutely fantastic. And, you know, I definitely always was taught to, you know, focus on how to make their lives better, you know, incrementally. And, you know, in general, you know, while obviously driving revenues, like try to get to 1% better every week on revenue as well.
You know. Yeah, 1% better every week. So it's an interesting, straight out of college, and you talk about intolerance of customer service after working there. I have to say, because I worked for Nordstrom right out of college and at the time, and it dates me, but at the time, I got very intolerant of customer service as well, because they were like the model to look at for customer service, right? And yeah. I remember going to places and just kind of, why doesn't everybody think in this light? Because it did produce, back in the day, they were a commission-based model, and mm-hmm. that was retail clothing. That was not the case during that time. And we sold top sales for books of business, the whole thing, because of the customer service aspect of it, for sure.
Yeah, whenever I've got some stressful purchase, let's say a suit ahead of a large event, you know, mm-hmm. that's where I'll go, just because I know I'll get taken care of, right? There's somebody, you know, I don't go there often because I'm cheap, but there was someone I went to like a year apart, and he remembered my name and was insane.
Yeah. So sometimes I teach different sales methodologies depending on what client I'm working with, right? Mm-hmm. And when you're setting up the revenue line, it's not just all about the sales team. So, yeah. But in that, this was about sales, and they literally had some of the best formal sales training that was very forward looking, because that was one of the things that you remember their name. You write every note down in your book, you remember their name, and you remember when they're having a baby, when they're doing. And I remember when my first daughter was born, many of my clients from Nordstrom, because I was very young at that time, many of them brought in baby blankets and gifts for me. And I was just like, and they were all asking when I was coming back. And it was like, but all it was know them and see them as human beings and needs, you know, and even in what I would call superficial fashion world, where they teach you, you know, fashion is all about scarcity and being on the next fashion, right? Mm-hmm. And so they try to make sure that you think that you're out of date before, you know, it's almost like tech sector, right? You're out mm-hmm. of date yesterday, right? And so it was actually the greatest roots for getting into revenue for tech sector, for healthcare, for everything that we've done, because it was very fast paced at the same time. And it was very interesting. So, yeah. And so right now you kind of carried that forward a little bit into your three startups. What, tell us about your startups. I'm curious, because I love startup stories, and I just think they're fun. Yeah,
I started my career at Oracle back when it was about 20 people. So that actually taught me that you could do big things with small teams. Oracle was already a big company, but the database team was really small. Yeah. And so from there, you know, I was getting ready to leave because I didn't feel like there was a lot of meaning in what I was doing. I mean, technically there was meaning, but, you know, it was getting bigger and bigger, and I was doing less and less. And so, my focus was narrowing. So that didn't really, I knew more and more about less and less. And that, you know, eventually knows means I know everything about nothing. And that's not where I plan. So I thought very hard about actually, you know, what would I want people to say about me at my eulogy? What's the life I wanted to live? And I was not on the path to that goal. And I was, if you're not on the path to your goal, you got to change your path or change your goal. And I didn't know. You know, I thought about, am I the person that could achieve that goal? And I was not.
Yeah.
But I am a pretty good engineer, so I can break big problems into small problems. So I went to a startup, which was 80 people, was the architect there. Mm-hmm. Then went to a startup that was maybe a dozen people, moved into engineering management. Then did my own startup, you know, which is obviously just me. And eventually, you know, sold that one as well. And then, you know, then spent a lot of time with, obviously, at the companies that acquired them, but ended up after that at AWS, which was kind of its own graduate degree, shall we call it, into driving revenue and growth.
Yeah.
And now doing a startup again.
Yeah, we'll talk about that in just a moment, because that's exciting. I mean, I really want to unpack, you know, you have to change your path or your goal, one mm-hmm. of the two. And I think sometimes there's fear in that. So how did you, you know, how did you come to that? Because obviously you would have comfort where you were at. So how did you overcome that? Because I know a lot of the listeners, they are startups, some of them small entrepreneurs and things like that. And I'm one. And I've done a couple of startups myself. And I have my ways of overcoming some of the stress behind what that fear is. But I'm just curious, how have you, what have you done to kind of do that?
I would say that I have gradually reduced the set of people whose opinions I care about.
Oh.
And, you know, like, they're like five, you know, and, you know, like,
you know, okay, like, now you got to list the five opinions if you're willing.
I mean, which is like my wife, my son, you know, like, you know, yeah. Like a few very close friends, you know, and, you know, what the reason that ends up mattering is that if you need to present, if you see yourself in like the mirror of other people's eyes, then what ends up happening is that you want to look a certain way. Right.
You, that's true.
Oh, this is where I work. This is what I do. This is what my job is. And the sad thing about startups is that you keep trading away that for, you know, like being a nobody trying to do a thing. Right. At least for most of your tenure in the startup before you sell it. And, you know, that helps. And, you know, the fact is that in that small group, they don't actually care. You know, whether I mean, they care whether I succeed or fail, but there isn't that investment into like, oh, you've got this, you're a VP at AWS or at Oracle or, you know, whatever. They don't care, right? They, so, you know, the, it's just different and it's refreshing. And then the trick of it really is to not have your ego, to reduce your ego and to reduce your sense to which you're defined by how, you know, you're perceived.
Yeah. Yeah. Wow.
Very empowering as well, right?
Because, you know, like, because you don't have the baggage.
Yeah, exactly, right? You don't have to care about like, oh, how is this person thinking about me, you know, and how do I appear so that in a way such that they will think better of me?
You know, it's, I've been kind of thinking about that through my journey in life. And of course, my adult children, in some ways, they're so much wiser than I am. I always look at that because I was just having a similar dialogue. And she's like, my oldest daughter was like, once you free yourself of the past baggage, you're so much lighter. Mm-hmm. And I just really, you know, it even boils down. I think you and I were talking early on in before we started the show, just taking that moment, but having that gratitude so that you are freeing yourself of all the negativity as well. And I'm not a guru. Trust me, I'm revenue. I'm a chief revenue officer. We're not gurus on all that stuff, but, it really is the burden. You know, we train, you know, revenue teams to get rid of the head trash. And the way to get rid of it is I sometimes say, check your ego at the door, first of all, because then there is nothing you've kind of, it's okay. If someone says no, you have permission to say no, and it doesn't affect you anymore.
So and here's the sort of path I'd say, like,
okay,
if you don't have, an obligation, you know, if you don't get your self-esteem through other people, then you can actually take on larger goals because it becomes okay to fail or achieve less. And, you know, I'd rather miss a big goal by a little than exceed a small goal by a lot, right? Like, two of my services at AWS, you know, sequentially were the fastest growing in AWS history, Redshift and then Aurora.
Yeah.
And in large part, it was because I had bigger things on my mind and, you know, and therefore I could take risks that maybe other people would be more conservative about.
Yeah. Yeah. My grandmother used to say something a little similar, and hopefully you will laugh, and maybe we will have to edit this out, but she used to always say, it's better to shoot for a pile for the stars and miss than shoot for a pile of manure and hit. And yeah, there's a lot of stories behind that.
I mean, it's tough when you're in sales, right? Because you've got a quota and you miss your quota, you're going to get fired. And, you know, so you get a little bit accustomed to under-promising, right?
Yeah.
And, you know, sandbagging and all of that. And so I think there's a trick in also how you think as a revenue leader, like you are, about how do you prevent sandbagging.
Yeah, you know, and it's an interesting subject because we're going into planning season and everything. And I was very fortunate to have some really good mentors that taught a few things on that subject to try to get sales team members especially to kind of calm down. But, you know, it's the whole that which we create, we support. And a lot of times we don't tap our sales team members in what they think they can create and allow them permission to fail. So in the, you know, I will quote Jack Stack in Great Game of Business, and, you know, Southwest Airlines was one of their, I don't know if they still are, one of their greatest things, but, it was really getting the sales team members involved in the five-year plan and not setting quota. And everybody will go, oh, no, you got to set quota. No, they have to set quota.
Sure.
You know, they need to feel like they are not, it's not handed to them, that they have some way of making that. And they come up with some of those ideas. Yes, you have in your mind what they need to make and that kind of thing. But I think a lot of times if they're a seasoned salesman, they already know that that's a little bit of the game to begin with. But on the, you know, I think the ones that really struggle, and I, you know, as a CRO, you cover sales, service, marketing, new product in these smaller companies. And a lot of times what happens is they just, it's so interesting to get marketing to actually quantify goals, right? Yeah. Because they see themselves as an expense, because CFOs see them as an expense, right? Instead of a revenue generator, and having them be part of the end-to-end funnel for whatever that is. And sometimes if it's completely inbound, really it's very marketing dependent to begin with, right? Yeah. So then when you talk to them and it's like, well, you know, why are you choosing that goal? They won't have an idea of why they're choosing it, or how to lower the customer acquisition cost, or how to, you know, some of that. And so that gets very scary sometimes for people who are not accustomed, you know, they just want to be told, hey, this is our goal by some leader and I don't have to prove it or explain why. But once they do, they really love it because they feel like they made that, just like an entrepreneur, like many entrepreneurs. Mm-hmm. I made that goal. Mm-hmm. I'm going to do or die until I get it, you know? So I love that.
Is there a point that you find in a growth journey where you have to change that from where you do have to set quotas for people?
So we're flipping the podcast on me. I am an advocate of still will and hill.
Okay.
So if they don't have the will, then, and they want you to set quota for them, they're probably not, in my arena, going to do as well. I typically, the reason why is some of your best in organizations are looking at the broader and bigger picture. Mm-hmm. And I think that there's different operating systems out there, right? Mm-hmm. But I think the one thing I did like about Great Game of Business is they would take massive organizations and they would change them to complete transparency, which would then have a top down, bottom up. Now the top obviously has to have a sense of what the answer is, right? You can't, giving sometimes maybe they shouldn't listen, but you know, maybe giving a child, hey, set your goal for not eating 20 suckers, right? You got to know what the kind of the boundaries are. But yeah. I think people respect when they don't have this, you know, hey, this is what the company wants to do. Now you explain your part in it and let us know what that is. And then we coach you up, or you coach, maybe you're in the wrong position. And I have changed people to other positions because it's more comfortable for them too. Even owning the churn, right? In your customer success teams, owning that churn is like your original premise that you said, find the pain. And in one of the podcasts, find the pain and heal it. Mm-hmm. And if you're customer success and you're not healing that pain, then you're going to have churn, mm-hmm. right? You really are going to have churn. So,
sure.
But I don't know. I'm going to flip the question back on you. Have you ever found a time that it would be time to flip it? I'm curious.
So I would not claim to be a revenue expert, but I've managed a lot of engineering teams, and it's very much the same kind of philosophy of, you know, set goals top down, but get schedules bottom up. And then you have to reconcile the two, because mm-hmm. finally you need people, you know, you want people to be accountable, but that kind of requires that they buy in, right? So I think it's exactly what you're saying in sales is very much true in engineering. And I can certainly say that it's true in engineering to arbitrary scales, give or take, right? But, you know, what you're doing is you're breaking it down team by team in terms of what their objectives and goals are. And then they're sort of doing it bottom up in the same way, and you kind of reconcile, sequentially.
And it's interesting. I've worked for a lot of engineers, and the thought process is very much that way. And when you're doing new product for engineers, a lot of times you've got to get it to the point where you can prove it almost like a business case to an investor, right? Because it's like, and I remember one of them just, I mean, we proved it every which way or what. And he just slammed his fist down and said, I don't know what else to ask you. And I'm like, well, I don't, you know, and I was working with this company at the time, and I'm like, we have given you every number. We've given you every statistic. We've given you the 5-year financials. We have showed you the sales team, the marketing team. We have gone through everything for this product. We even have done customer trials where they say they want to buy this. And price elasticity, we went through the whole thing. And he finally, I said, what is it that you need to be convinced? And he said, I need to know with 100% certainty that we will win. And I went, wow. Okay. No executive summary on that one.
Yeah.
But it was a good proving ground. I will say that, because it was very helpful to understand what the thought process was behind what the hesitancy was, for sure. And he was literally in pain. I don't know how to make a decision because I got to know 100% for sure this will win. And it's like, I can't tell.
In the wrong job then, right?
I mean, yeah. At
Amazon, they had these OKR kind of model. They called it esteem goals because they're visible to Jeff and his directs, the senior leadership team.
Sure.
But there's this meta goal that you make about 70% of your goals.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, not, you know, you hit 100% of 70% of your goals, not you hit 70% of 100% of your goals, right? So, and that's important because that's what prevents the sandbagging, right? That lets you stretch.
Sure. And I think if you add, and going back to your question about the sandbagging too, then you add the visibility.
Yeah.
So if it's transparent and weekly, everybody sees where they stand and what they're doing, then, and how it affects whatever their goals are, mm-hmm. and they're not making them, then there's a challenge there, right? Yep. So how do you, and then you start to get to a point where it's like, you show the data of how they've performed in the past and you say, look, you can do this. Mm-hmm. You know, if you take, hey, this is what the economy is saying. This is what all this other stuff is saying. You've helped look into this. And then you say something to the effect of, what do you want? What do you want in your life? What do you, you know, and because I care more about what they want in their life than I care. I love the companies. Don't get me wrong. So please don't misquote me on that. Mm-hmm. But I want them to be happy because they do well when they're happy in their role. If they're not, crud, I've gone out and helped them find new jobs even, mm-hmm. you know, that I'm like, man, your skill set is so awesome in this. Let's get you a job in this, you know, mm-hmm. and then the head trash or sandbagging goes away and, mm-hmm. you know, they're in the right place, right seats on the bus. But mm-hmm. anyway, so yeah, I don't know if I answered your question, but now I'm going to flip it back on you and ask you a question. So you've talked about engineering and you've talked about all of what you were doing, getting into, you know, the startups and some of those things. But, you know, when you were young, college, how did you decide you wanted to get into this kind of arena?
Oh, that's interesting. I don't know that I did. You know, when I was young, I kind of wanted to be a lawyer, but then I kind of also realized that over time that I was a better engineer than, you know, other things. So, you know, eventually, you know, you get paid for doing the things you do well, but which people value, right? Like,
yeah.
I was better at English and history than I was at STEM, you know, yeah. but, you know, you don't get paid, right? You know, I didn't grow up with a lot of money. So, you know, I kind of needed to, you know, make some. So, yeah. So that's what
you kind of need to make some. Okay. Mm-hmm. We're going to have to laugh a little bit about this because we know that people say if you do what your passion is, you never work a day in your life. How true is that?
I think maybe I'm a weirdo, but I just find that I'm able to get passionate about a lot of different things. And so, you know, yeah, as long as I have sort of some authority, autonomy, you know, control, I can get passionate about anything.
Yeah. Yeah. It's an attitude a little bit, right?
I'm not saying it's true for other people or that they can be that person. I'm just saying that, you know, I can get super interested in all sorts of weird things. So,
yeah. And it was the question for you. So, you know, that's how it is. I think it is easier if you have that. I know when I was young, I thought, okay, I'm going to be, I thought I was going to be in a rock band, but of course that didn't happen. But I was an opera singer for many, many years. But, you know, unless you're the 0.001%, you don't make money as a musician. It becomes a side gig while you have to make money. So I had to learn at a very young age to say, okay, what can you get passionate about? How do you get passionate about it? So you do love what you're doing at the time you're doing or looking for it. I know.
That doesn't mean you can't sing as a side thing, right?
Exactly. Definitely,
Einstein was a patent clerk, you know, but it paid the bill so you could develop the general theory of relativity.
Exactly. Just that little thing. Well, that is so interesting. So how did we get to Shoreline.io? Let's talk a little bit about this company, because this is your newest thing.
So, I mean, we're really focused on reliability and resiliency for a company's applications and infrastructure. Mm-hmm. You know, so one of the things that was pretty clear at AWS was that everyone's moving to the cloud. Great.
Sure.
Now, people have largely automated their testing, their configuration management, their deployment. It's, you know, there's more stuff getting shipped faster, you know, sometimes many times a day at a company like at a hyperscaler anyway. But then you turn it over to day two operations and suddenly becomes manual at most places. That's kind of nuts, because that if it's manual, it introduces human error. It introduces lag time, you know, while your customer's suffering. It, you know, it's a lot of it's repetitive and mundane. And, you know, so that seemed insane to me. You know, what you do in the hyperscalers is that you automate all that stuff away.
Yeah.
And so, you know, why isn't that happening at most companies? It's because they don't have the tooling for it. You know, we all know that we should be, you know, like running a more reliable environments, but why don't we? So, you know, that was the problem I set out to solve, because, you know, none of us like getting woken up by a pager or having to, you know, walk away from some family barbecue in order to deal with an outage, you know, and yet we do, right? And so it just seems like the more you can reduce that, you know, the happier everyone is, because this is not the work people set out to do when they got their degrees, right? Sure. It's the work that they have to do. It, you know, so, you know, it's the tax that you pay in order to do the interesting work. And so, yeah, it felt like, you know, that was a great problem to go after.
Yeah. Well, you've addressed several things in there. You know, a lot of times it is they don't want to do that, but they will come back and go, well, we just don't have the money. We just don't have the, you know, if we were bigger, you hear that all the time. If we were bigger, we would do this. I'm working for a cyber risk company is one of my clients, and cyber risk transference governance as a service, right? And they're the GR side of the fence, but we're all staring down the pipe of various different frameworks and things. And you have Gartner and everybody saying, you're not going to be ready. You're going to lose 50% of your contracts, blah, 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 blah. Right. And everybody's, oh, I'm not big enough to handle that. And it's like, so you're big enough to lose a $20 million contract? Yeah. For maybe 0.001% of your revenue. You know, it just doesn't make any sense. And you're running up against the same thing when it's like, no one wants to leave a barbecue. How much time? You can quantify that. You're an engineer. How much time a year would that literally save?
Yeah. So it's easier to have that conversation with like a VP engineer than it is with the, you know, leaf level people, because the problem is that, you know, up at the top, you're thinking, okay, I got 50 more headcount this year. How much of it do I want to allocate towards operations versus innovation, you know, keeping the lights on versus developing new stuff? Ideally, you want to allocate most of it towards innovation, because that's also how you drive revenue. That's how your company grows, right?
Yeah.
And but the problem is that the operational toil is sort of peanut buttered over everybody.
I love that, like, peanut buttered over.
And so it's a little bit, you know, it's hard for people to view it as, you know, like the acute cost pain, right? Yeah. So, you know, you have to find ways to help them recognize both the acute cost, you know, the 12-hour outage, as well as the everyday mundane costs that are actually the ones that, you know, sap time and energy.
For sure, yeah. Yeah, it's okay. That's the key takeaway. Operations is sort of peanut buttered. I'm sorry. You're probably going, what on earth? No, but it, yeah. I mean, I think sometimes you talked about it at the very beginning. You got into it to heal a pain, right? And to work through that. Sometimes we don't realize we have pain that could be.
We don't realize that the pain is solvable, right?
Yeah.
If I had a, chronic knee pain, and I might just think, okay, well, this is my lot in life and I will limp along. And, thankfully I don't. But, I might not know that there were things available to help me. Or I might be scared of, a surgery. So I think the same things are true in, the software we sell, that people are accustomed to their everyday and, they're often scared of change, period.
Well, and I learned this from Challenger. I don't know if you know Matt Dixon in that group, but they used to always say the pain of same has got to be greater than the pain of change. Right. Now, it's a tongue twister to some people, but the reality is if your knee aches and you're fearful of it, then the pain of same is not greater than the, it's not greater than the change. So you're going to just limp along for the rest of the time until it gets to a point where you do go seek out help. Mm-hmm. And I think it kind of goes back to, and I'm guilty of this. I'm going to just say it because it's true. We tend to let our egos get in the way and say, I can do this. I don't need this. I don't need to solve this challenge because I can do it.
Weirdly, even the badge of honor, right? Like, oh, I stayed up all night to deal with this customer issue. Well,
And I just did that. Oh my gosh, I just did that. I was like, oh, I stayed up all night. My husband's in the hospital. I stayed up all night to get this proposal. I should have just kicked it down to the, we all do it. Isn't that sad?
we take so much pride in it. You have to invert it, right? Like, who do you give credit to? The person who's, just like where everything is running cleanly without any drama, or the person who very dramatically, comes in and, like saves the day,
That's true.
I don't know.
I hunt out the first. Yeah. I hunt out the one who is making things just run smoothly, and then make sure I appreciate him all the time.
Overlooked, right?
Yeah, because I don't want him overlooked. I'm like, I know you're doing that, and I need to, versus the drama king or queen, that's coming in. It's like, well, you are a one hit.
Yeah, you see that in customer success, by the way. Just to try to get back to Revenue Maze, right? Yeah. That it's easy to see the person who is sort of like wins a deal where there's an angry customer. As a renewal, it's hard to see the person who just has happy customers.
Yeah. Yeah. Right. Yeah. And it's human nature. It's kind of interesting. It's like, we know that was a hard customer. So we're all going to go, yay. And you're like, and how many hard customers you went? Yeah, totally. Well, it sounds super interesting. I really love it. You have one more thing that I'm going to just point out. I know you have a gazillion. We could talk for hours because, well, quite frankly, I'm a talker. But, and I'm glad you smiled and laughed at that. But you also are very active in, pediatric health and special needs children. Is there anything that you would love to get out to the public about, any causes or anything that you're working through on that? And you can say no, I'm okay.
Yeah, nothing deep there. But I guess one thing I'd say is, like, my wife's a board member on Communication First, as an example of one of the things we support. And, they're basically focused on saying that, the ability to communicate is a human right. It's, like, we believe in free speech, but, there are people who can't communicate through standard modalities like speech. And, but that doesn't mean they couldn't communicate on a letterboard or a keyboard or with some sort of assistive device, given And you know, the challenge is that we kind of associate the ability to speak cogently with intelligence, and therefore so many people get overlooked. You know, like suddenly, you know, like let's say move it away from autism to like someone has a stroke but was a doctor before that or surgeon, and that afterwards we're treating them as though they're infantile. No, it's the same intelligent person underneath the covers. It's they lost some capacity to speak. That doesn't mean they've lost their intelligence. So, you know, I think that infantilization, sorry, I'm getting the word screwed up, you know, of people with disabilities is a challenge. It's one that I think we all need to think about.
I think we do. It's kind of like when somebody, when you're speaking with somebody in a foreign language and you speak louder, you know, I'm a fan of the story for Helen Keller. What a massively intelligent human being. And had her parents not done what they had done, no one would know. Not a soul would know. I mean, there's the Stephen Hawking's, there's so many out there that are brilliant minds. And we look at disability, just like you said, And it is, people need to be seen regardless of their challenges. We all have them. We all have them. We might look normal, but we all have them. And so they need to be
normal anyway. Right.
I was going to say, I'm not sure nowadays. The foundation has shifted so much in my generation that, I don't know what normal is or even why the word is used, but I guess it's our baseline. OKRs, right? We have our OKRs that are expected. So anyways, that's fabulous. So it has been so much fun to have you on the show. I personally thank you because I needed this conversation today. I don't know how many others needed it, but I needed this conversation today. It has been amazing. And where is one place that they could get a hold of you about shoreline.io or
they could just reach out to me at Anurag, A-N-U-R-A-G at shoreline.io.
Perfect. Yeah, that's awesome. And again, thank you all for listening. It has been an amazing episode today. And give Anurag some love, share, like, post, tweet, do whatever you want to do. And anyways, and thank you all again for listening and just hope to have you back next time.
I'd love to. All right. Take care. Bye.
Thank you all for joining another great episode. Hats off to all you small businesses out there. I can't wait for the next episode.